RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
I got to speak with John Whitehead yesterday. John is one of the two commissioners for the New Zealand Royal Commission on the COVID response. You may recall I spoke to him way back at the beginning of the process, back when they were first calling for submissions, and he was very appreciative of how Reality Check Radio encouraged people to submit their stories. He recognised that there was some distrust in the process, but that we at RCR really helped to drive the engagement with the New Zealand public. So that was great to hear. And so now they've finished the interview stage of the inquiry and they're sitting down to write what I'm sure is going to be a massive document. So he couldn't talk specifics and preempt what's going to be in the report, but he was happy to talk in general about what he'd learned. And so I began just by asking him how it had all gone since we last spoke. So, John, thank you for being here to speak. We spoke a few months ago as you kicked off the public submissions period of the inquiry. I have to say, I was filled with a little bit of optimism, actually, at the time, because I thought that you were very sincere in your wish to do a proper job. How's the experience been?
Thank you, Alistair, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to join with you today and speak to you and your listeners. Look, it's been an amazing experience, it's been something which I suppose is, you know, in some ways life-changing to be able to hear what people's experiences have been, why they did things which they did, how they felt about what was done to them. And it's been a real privilege to hear that. And the public submissions process was, I think, really valuable for us because it highlighted the things that people were particularly interested in exploring and saying and the lessons they were drawing out of what happened. Yes, it's been a real privilege. I think it's really helped inform our report.
What's been your overall impression? What's the overall experience that New Zealand has had during the COVID era, do you think?
It's interesting. I think it's very, very mixed. People draw distinctions between the early part and the latter part of the pandemic and the response to it. We had in the public submissions process some very positive comments, some very negative comments, but actually a lot of them were quite nuanced. I mean, people that were positive were also perhaps sometimes worried about certain things. People that were very negative about what had happened were sometimes saying, well, yes, but there was this positive element and so on. So it was a bit more nuanced than I might have expected, if I can put it that way.
The dust is settling a little bit, perhaps.
I think so. People are reflecting and I think looking forward, which is really good. You know, I mean, one of our themes is we're looking backwards to look forward so that we can help identify some of those lessons for next time.
It does seem, looking at the list of the groups and the people that you've spoken to, and I have to say, it's an incredibly long list. I'm actually in awe of how much work you guys have put into this. But it does seem like there's a lot of people and organisations that were part of the infrastructure of the COVID response. How did they think that they did?
So you're there, Alistair, you're meaning people that were involved in advising or making decisions?
Yes. And government departments and government-linked organisations that helped coordinate the whole response.
I think that was one of the advantages in the way we were able to approach this as a sort of a discussion around a table really set it up in a way that would encourage people to be free and frank. Again, it was quite nuanced, I think. You got some people that were quite positive, very positive. Others that were quite self-critical and saying, you know, if I had my time again, if I knew then what I know now, I would have done it a bit differently. So it was, you know, I was actually quite impressed at people's willingness to speak and be very frank with us.
Okay, I need to ask you about some of the criticisms of the inquiry. Much of those criticisms have been around the terms of reference and the scope. It does seem that there's a lot of things. There are almost more things out of the scope than in. You weren't allowed to look, for instance, at the vaccine efficacy, which does seem strange to a lot of us when the whole COVID response was based around locking everyone in their homes until we had a vaccine and then mandating this brand new vaccine product that had no long-term safety data. These were obvious things that a lot of us saw. And it does seem strange that that's left out, but that's just one example. And I suppose the question is, you did the work. Did you feel limited?
It was possible to interpret our terms of reference quite widely. We have looked at vaccine mandates, for example. We've looked at the lockdowns issue. We've looked at some of the specific lockdowns. We've looked at a wide range of issues. You're right, the vaccine safety and efficacy was not part of those terms of reference. But you're right also, it does bear on some of those issues. And I think that is, we've been able, I think, to address that as far as we can and draw some conclusions about mandates and lockdowns and all the other measures. But I think it's one of the advantages of having the phase two of the inquiry, which will be able to go into that issue and also into more depth on some of the issues where, just because we had so much to cover, we haven't been able to go to the depth that ideally you might want to go to.
Do you have any advice for the phase two people that are coming in to do that phase two?
That's a really good question, Alistair. I think it's, what I would say was, and it's what they will do, because, I mean, the three people I know of, the three people that have been appointed, they're people of integrity, they're people of open minds and independent, real willingness to be independent. And I think that's the point. Once you sit down into the inquiry, you say, look, this is just too important to be bringing our own prejudices, if you like, to this. We have to listen, we have to learn, we have to really identify the lessons that come out of this, because it's so important, that we do as well as we can next time and the time afterwards. Mm.
The list of people that you've spoken to, as I said, it's actually an incredible list, but it does seem that the list is basically, I feel that a lot of it is the people who built the COVID era. And I noticed there are some individuals in there, like, say, for instance, Sean Hendy and Michael Baker and Susie Wiles, who have been amplified consistently in a positive manner by both our media and our government. And I say this also, I should say also that I do know that you talked to the Voices for Freedom leadership team, not once, but twice. So that's fantastic, and I acknowledge that. But if you were speaking to the individuals like the ones that I mentioned, who were amplified constantly on a daily basis, why didn't you go and speak to the individuals who suffered the most, or who were ignored the most? I'm talking about people like the family of Rory Nairn, who died after having the injection, or the likes of Casey Hodgkinson and Rob Martin, who ended up in wheelchairs with horrific injuries from those injections. They were vocal within the anti-mandate community, so they should have been on the radar, but they were ignored by our media. Isn't this an opportunity to have those voices heard too? Why aren't those names on the list on your website?
I think what I would say to that is it's impossible for us to talk to everybody, and you'll understand that, because everybody was affected in some way or another. So what we've tried to do is reach out to those people that might be not representative, but would have an experience that people could relate to. And so, for example, we did spend quite a bit of time talking to bereaved families and the experiences they'd had. And we did go to, we were very keen, and look, can I thank you, because I think you on RCR were very helpful in encouraging people to engage with us. We did speak with Voices for Freedom. We did eventually speak to New Zealand doctors speaking out on science, for example. Okay. So, those groups coming in, I think, originally a bit reluctant perhaps to talk to us because of the controversy around the terms of reference, but actually then felt at the end, by the end, it was actually well worthwhile talking to us. And we learned a lot from that exchange, and I'm really hopeful they benefited from it too.
Yeah, I also remember, I bring up those names, Casey Hodgkinson and Rob Martin. And the reason I bring them up is because I was filming at events, for instance, one in particular at the Auckland Domain one time when they were both speaking. And Rob Martin, especially, I remember, they were both in wheelchairs. They'd been injected because of their jobs. They'd been mandated to take these injections, and they'd been injured. And Rob Martin especially was in a terrible situation. Somebody had to hold the microphone for him because he had such bad damage to his nervous system that he couldn't actually hold it for himself. And I was filming because I'm a filmmaker. I make documentaries about this subject. And I turned my camera around to see whether the media who were there were filming, and they'd turned their cameras off. And so I see this opportunity that you guys have as a chance for those people to have their stories told. They were called anti-vaxxers in a lot of instances when they were actually the ones that had taken it. So that's why I'm interested in hearing about those people.
And I think, Alistair, that's one of the good things about phase two, that that area that was, you know, vaccine safety, that was outside our terms of reference, the commissioners there will be able to hear comment directly on those sorts of issues.
Okay, I have to also ask you about Professor Tony Blackley's involvement. He was an advisor to the government during the COVID era. And so to have him not just involved, but in charge of the inquiry, to justify his own positions, essentially, and his actions and those of his colleagues, it just seems a little bit, to a lot of people, like a student marking his own paper. Has that made the job any harder, knowing that there's this massive impression of a conflict of interest hanging over his involvement?
So can I say perhaps two things about that, that touch on that? One is that in both phases of the inquiry, the process of selecting the commissioners has been done by the government, but on the advice of the Department of Internal Affairs. And they go through those conflict issues quite rigorously, and are asking themselves, can these be managed or can they not? And the people that are eventually selected, if you like, pass that process. I think the other comment I'd make is there wouldn't be a person in this country that doesn't have some conflict. We're all affected by what happened in COVID. It's just very hard to totally remove that prior experience, if you like. What I think is really important is the way people conduct themselves in the inquiry. And we were talking earlier about independence and the importance of independence and taking an independent view. I would have to say with Tony, he has been shown incredible integrity in that whole process. I've probably observed him more closely than anyone, along with Heike Parata, who was with us as a third commissioner for a while. And Tony is, you know, very prepared, to be self-critical, very open to us myself disagreeing with him and, you know, talking through the issues and so on. I have not felt dominated by him at all. In actual fact, it's been a real privilege to work with him.
Mm. But you must agree. I mean, he was in the room when these decisions were being made. There is an impression of that conflict of interest, surely.
Yeah, look, there's always that impression. We declared our conflicts when we joined. I mean, I'm, the chairperson of Harapani St. John. I declared that. I have some family members that were doctors, or psychiatrists or whatever. I declared that. And being very open about those means that it's on the table. You can take action to make sure that if it's not appropriate for you to be part of, that part of the, an interview process where you might have a conflict of that nature, you can exclude yourself from it. I understand people's perceptions, but the reality is that when you sit down as a commissioner, you have to say to yourself, this is too important. I found that with Tony. I've certainly sought to do that myself, and I have confidence in the three new commissioners who I know of, they're people of integrity, and I think they will do the same.
And look, I heard what our Voices for Freedom ladies who came to speak to you talked about their involvement and what they had to say about the process and how Professor Tony Blackley conducted himself. And there were only good things that they said. So that's really interesting to hear your thoughts on that. I do want to move on to the next one. The next one is on the subject of government communication. And I'm talking directly here to within the scope government communication, and this one's the subject of government communication from, in particular, Jacinda Ardern and Michael Wood. Jacinda Ardern, on the 23rd of October 2021, told a New Zealand Herald journalist that her intention was to create a two-class society of vaccinated and unvaccinated people. Then there was also Michael Wood, who called the protesters outside Parliament in February 2022 a river of filth, Islamophobes, anti-Semites and fascists. I can personally tell you that there were none of those things there, because I was there and I saw it and I filmed it, and there was nothing of the sort. How are you approaching these examples of government communication, which is within your scope, these deliberate, cynical attempts to divide New Zealanders in a time of crisis, one of the biggest crisis points in our nation's history, and this kind of language is being used by our representatives, our Prime Minister, no less?
You're right, communication is part of our terms of reference, and we will be commenting on that in the Royal Commission. I can't tell you right now what we'll be saying, because that has to wait until we report. But social cohesion, if I can put it that way, the sense of division, if you like, that did emerge during the process is definitely part of what we will be looking at and addressing. I mean, it's not a thing that there are necessarily easy answers to. Look, like you, I was for a little while down in Parliament. This is in a different role I have. I was chair of the Board of Trustees looking over the Wellington Cathedral, which, as you know, is right next to Parliament, and a number of people were camping on the cathedral grounds and so forth. And cathedral opened the doors to them. Look, I've always found, and it's what I was saying earlier about the submission process, people are much more nuanced than, you know, is often, you know, portrayed publicly, if I can put it that way. I spoke to some lovely people, and there are people I may have disagreed with, people I may have agreed with, but, you know, and some expressed themselves a lot more forcefully than others. And there was a little bit of misbehaviour, I think, when I was around. Hopefully I didn't contribute to that in any way. But, you know, people are people, aren't they? You know, so it's, I think we need to, you know, looking forward, be emphasising what we can learn from those experiences and how we minimise social divisions in the future. And I think I'm not commenting on any particular minister's statements or anything, or anybody else's statements, but calling people names never helps, I find, in discourse.
And if we are looking forward into the future, and both you and Tony Blakely have been quite consistent in the way that you've said this, that if it is going to happen again, then we need to learn from this. That sort of division, to me, is the hallmark of the entire COVID era, this division of people. I remember one point when I was at the protest there filming, I was standing on a traffic island down there outside the law school, and a bus driver stopped in front of me and said, pulled down his window and said, "I hope you all get COVID and die." This was the kind of language and rhetoric, the kind of social division that was being passed down right from the very top. So I guess the question there is, will you be addressing that in your report?
Well, we'll certainly be addressing the importance of looking to bring people with you as much as possible, to engage with people not only that agree with you but also disagree with you, because you can always learn from that side of things. And I think people, even if you end up disagreeing, people respect the fact that you engage and are willing to hear. And I've always, you know, in my entire career, and had a long career now, as you will realise, I found that often my critics have been my best friends, because I've, you know, been able to learn. Maybe I had my mind changed, or maybe I thought, well, actually, no, they had a point, and if I address it this way rather than that way, then it may actually work much better. So, you know, I think those, you know, being open to, you know, all voices is quite important.
Okay, last question. When are we going to see the report? How much more work have you got to do, and when are we going to see it?
Well, we're busy, writing at the moment sending drafts off to people who may think we're, you know, might be at risk of thinking some of our findings are adverse to them. And, you know, there's a natural justice process where you give them an opportunity to say, well, no, hold on, that's not fair, or, well, maybe it is, or whatever. So we're writing on our findings, on our lessons, and putting together some recommendations. And I hope, you know, when our report is published, you know, people will realise we're taking this very seriously, that we've really looked for those lessons, that we've been open to what people have raised with us, that's, and the, particularly those things that are important from them. People have said they've benefited from talking, from speaking to us, and we've done, you know, our genuine best to listen to people, and we've certainly benefited from hearing them, you know, from all parts of the spectrum, those that were very positive, those that were very negative.
So is there a date that we can expect it, or is it just wait and see? Because I appreciate how much work. You just have to look through that list of people on your website who you've spoken to realise how big a job it is.
Yeah, look, we deliver our report to the minister on the 28th of November. It's the minister's call exactly when it's published. But my understanding is she's keen to get it published and get on with phase two. So I would imagine probably reasonably soon after the 28th of November, the government will want to, you know, obviously have a little time to consider what's said there first, which is understandable. But my understanding is it won't be long after that.
Mm. Hey, look, John, I want to thank you for fronting for this interview. I know that a lot of these questions may even sound like criticisms, but that's the nature of the questions that people have around this topic. And so I thank you very much for making yourself available. And congratulations on getting yourself through it. It's a massive amount of work, and we thank you for that.
And thank you, Alistair, and you know, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners. I really appreciate it.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.